Now also, all the way from the FOMO, we have our 50-minute speaker. This is Bob.
However long you want to go.
What time is it?
8:15.
Oh, okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Bob. I'm not
alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be in a meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. You just heard the second greatest thing that ever happened to me. When I'm an alcoholic. I know that I'm an alcoholic. When I drink, I can't predict how much it's going to cost, where I'm going to go, where it's going to end up, what's going to happen to me. And then, I'm not going to be able to remember it. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic. My dad's dad was an alcoholic. My grandma was an alcoholic. And I grew up in a household where everybody was either an alcoholic or a drug addict. But that's not why I'm an alcoholic. We didn't have any money. We were kind of poor. We lived in Los Angeles. But that's not why I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I have an allergy to drugs and alcohol. And I passed over some imaginary line. I don't know where it was. I don't know when I passed it. That I can't drink without starting the phenomenon of craving. And I'm a blackout drinker. I had my first blackout when I was 14. I don't remember the first beer that I had, but I remember the first time I smoked weed. And I got out from my mom's stash. My mom and my parents all drank and used all the time. But I don't know what my first drink was, but I know that my first blackout was on alcohol when I was 14. And it didn't scare me. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was risque. Like, I started smoking cigarettes when I was 7, because I didn't know I was 7. And Jeff, welcome. This can work. If you want it to work, if you do it, we can't do it for you. There's no spray. There's not one. And I don't know what you should do, but this is what I did. I was thinking about this on the way over here. I never did anything anybody ever told me to do. I mean, unless they had their foot on my neck, I wasn't going to do it. I didn't believe they knew what they were talking about. If I'd done anything I should have done, I would be in the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on Saturday night. But all of that, dropped out of school, joined the Army when I was 17, because I was sick of people telling me what to do. I don't have a medium setting, and I lack common sense. So I remember my 18th birthday. Well, I say that I remember. I remember the beginning of the evening. I had a handful of Black Beauties, and I bought it at Boone's Farm. I was in Aberdeen, Maryland, and then it was the next day. We give chips at meetings, and I really like the 60-day chip. Because before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and went to treatment, I'd never had 30 days clean and sober, except for the first month in basic training when I was 17. And the second time I had it, I was locked in a treatment center. But that 60-day chip, that meant something to me, because that was 30 days not in a hospital, on my own, going to meetings, and it happened. The Army for me was a great place to learn how to think and use. I ended up in Germany. I spent 3 years in Germany. I like to drive. I'm a way better driver when I drink. I don't know about you. Alcohol is a depressant, but that's not my experience with it. My experience with alcohol is when I drink and use, I want to yell, and I want to run, I want to fight, I want to drive. I want to have a really good time right now. And I had two car wrecks. And when I was in Germany, it took me a head-on collision with a semi in a Carnegie. And it was amazing, though, because it was in slow motion, and I ended up having a hitchhike home on the Autobahn, which is hard to hit that on the Autobahn. They go by really fast. I got married when I was 18 to a girl I met in a small town. Lived in a small town in Oregon, Little Creek. And I just didn't have a clue. You know, Tammy talked about, you know, not being afraid of dying. I really wasn't afraid of dying. I really wasn't. I had a real low, you know, sense of self. When I got back from Germany, I ended up in Georgia. God was a weird thing. When I was a kid, any church that had a bus, my mom would stick us on Sunday. And so I had a real weird thing about God. Like when they would read stuff, I like the stuff, like there's a red letter edition Bible. And so it's the stuff all that Jesus said is in red, and then everything that everybody said he said, or meant he said, or said he said he said. Well, that's all in black. But the red stuff was all about love and taking care of each other and helping other people. All that, I can get on board with that. But I just had a whole disconnect from that. But I thought there had to be something. I didn't know what it was. When I lived in Georgia, I smoked a lot of weed and drank a lot. And I ended up having a car wreck, flipped a car, doing about 80. What happened was, I was with my friend Tony. He was driving. We'd been drinking all day long. We were sliding sideways, and we ran out of pavement, hit the dirt, kind of pitched up in the air. And I was in the passenger seat, and I had my arm and my head out. And as the car was flying through the air, I looked straight out, and I saw the sky, and I heard this loud voice that said, "Pull your head in, stupid." And when I woke up, the windshield was smashed, my jaw was broken, my shoulder was dislocated. But I was alive. And I don't know if that was God. I don't really know, but I know that I heard that voice, and I know it gave me a nickname. And so, that's the best nickname, but when you look at the picture, nicknames do. I got out of the Army and ended up in, you know, every time that I would have a change of duty station, I would swear off. That was a geographic for me, because I would swear, I was like, okay, I'm not going to drink or use. I really got to get my shit together. And I always fail, because when I came to AA, they read a thing, and they read it in chapter 3, it says, "To control and enjoy of drinking is the greatest testament of every abnormal drinker." And I never heard that until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I pretty much knew that from the time I was 16. I knew that I couldn't drink the way that I wanted to and be a success. Because I never really accomplished anything. You know, a lot of people come into AA and they had something and they lost it. I never really had anything. When I got out of the Army, I went to an AA meeting with my dad. My dad got his 7 feet wide. He bought him. He went to the VA. He goes, "I'm going to go to the meeting or come with me." And my heart of hearts, I really wanted AA to be the answer. So we smoked a couple of joints, and then we went to this AA meeting. And it was in a small town in Oregon, and it was just me and my dad and one other guy. And they read some stuff out of the book. You guys got books. They read some stuff out of the book. And I remember leaving thinking, that's not what I'm looking for. It was really, by the time I was 22, I was looking for a way out. I was looking for a way to not have to drink and use, because by that time, I could not drink and use. I was drinking and using to be normal. I was already using anger to get what I wanted. I was already using whatever I could just to be okay, just to get my medicine to be okay. And so, I cheated on my wife, and I was, I had a thing with speed. I don't know if you ever get any speed, but I had a thing with speed. And the third day I would have like an epileptic seizure. And so the first time I did it, it scared me so bad. And then the second time it happened, I was really concerned. By the third time, So this girl that I was having sex with, who wasn't my wife, she was in debt to it. And You know, it's funny thing about inheritance and alcoholics and illness, I heard is one's vice is not habit. When I first started drinking and using it, it was risque, it was cool, it was fun. But then what happens is it normalized. And it just became the things that I did and how I acted and what I did and that level. And those, you know, they talk about, you know, cohorts and places. That, you know, that whole level of friends and people that I interacted with got smaller and smaller and riskier and riskier and riskier. And in the end, it was, I really didn't have any social gatherings that I was a part of, or I really didn't have any groups that I hung out with. I had my wife and my three kids, and I had drug addicts that I was buying from and selling to, and that was pretty much the people I interacted with. I didn't have any friends really at work, except when I was at work, because I didn't want them to know. I knew what I was living wasn't okay, but I just didn't know how to stop it. I really didn't. And so, the night before I went to treatment, I was sitting in my living room. I was pretty drunk. I was pretty lonely. And I knew that I was going to inject the speed, and I knew that it was going to kill me. And then the weirdest thing happened was I had a moment of clarity, and I wasn't really high, and I wasn't drunk. And I continued to play that tape. And yeah, that was going to kill me, but my family was going to be better off, because I really wasn't the thing that I pretended that I was. I wasn't a good husband. I wasn't a good father. I was absent. I would stop off work. I'd get off work at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I would stop by the bar for one beer. And my drink of choice was Red Bull, which is Schlitz malt liquor and tomato juice. I mean, it's the perfect drink. But I would stop off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for one beer, and I couldn't get home before 10. And I would come home, and the kids would already be in bed. You know, I wasn't taking anybody to soccer. I wasn't doing any of that. I was just continuing to work and use. And it's pretty much my life. And I had that moment of clarity, and I saw my life as it actually was, that I was an unfaithful husband. And my career, I was in an apprenticeship program to be a millwright, a plywood mill. And, you know, it wasn't getting better. I'd already, you know, one night I was out drinking, and I knew that I had to be at work at 6 a.m. and I knew I wasn't going to make it. And at 3 o'clock, I wrote this fancy note and put it on my boxing door telling me that my dad happened to go to an emergency, because I just wasn't going to make it. And I wasn't good to my dad. And I knew that if I did that, I was going to die, and that was okay. And I was okay with dying. I really was. I wasn't okay with continuing to live the way that I was living. So I was sitting in my living room, and I wasn't drunk as I should have been, and I saw a commercial on TV. And there were two glasses smashing into each other, and it said, "You, or someone you know, has a problem with drugs and alcohol, call this number." And I said to my wife, "I'm going to call that number." And I go, "But I'm not going to give you any information. I just want to find out what this thing is." And I talked to a nurse that was at the hospital. And I talked to her for 10 minutes. And in 10 minutes, she had my name, my social security number, my insurance carrier, and I was going to be there in the morning. And then she goes, "Now, Bob, when you hang up, call your boss and tell them that you have a problem with drugs and alcohol and you are going to a treatment center." And I said, "Okay." And I hung up and I called my boss and I told him, and he said the worst thing he possibly could. He said, "Bob, go and complete that treatment program. Your job is safe. We only want the best for you." So I'm like, this is happening. So that night, I opened that bottle of wine that I've been saving for a special occasion, and I pulled out the bong that I had since I was 16, and I went through everything I had in the house, and at 7 o'clock, New Year's Eve, 1985, a.m., I showed up at a hospital in Roseburg, Oregon, for my new life. Because she didn't say anything about AA, but she did say that if I did this 28-day program, I would get a new life. And that's really all I really wanted. I really wanted a chance to restart this mess. I really wanted a chance. That's really all I wanted, was a chance. Because I knew the way it was going. It's kind of like, I don't know if you can relate to this, but I shot a lot of guns. I was in the military. My dad always, but when you shoot higher power rifles, it's the weirdest thing. There's a space between when you hear the hammer drop and the bullet goes. And because when you're doing that, you're really focused on it. You're really focused on it, and you hear it, and it'll go click, and then boom. And basically what happened was, I pulled the trigger, and I had to follow through on it. So I showed up at this treatment program, ready to do it, and I was in the admissions office. I did not want to be an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. He was a terrible drunk. I had memories of him beating my mom up, wrecking cars, destroying equipment. I want to be a drug addict. It's so much more. So I'm in the admissions office, and I see my paperwork, and I fill it out, and I see my name, my birthday, Blair, and I see where it says diagnosis, and it says chronic alcoholism. And I said, you know what, I am not an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. And she said to me, she said, well, your insurance doesn't cover drug addiction, but it covers alcoholism. And I'm like, well, how much does this thing cost? I'm not an alcoholic. I have to do this. And she told me, and I said, wow, I guess I'm an alcoholic. And that was the moment I became an alcoholic. Up before that, there's no way I'd ever admit to it. I'm just, couple of days, laying around, sleeping in the mist, got an AA meeting. I'm like, come on, that's pretty good. So we had to walk double file down to the Red Cross. And it was way different this time. Well, first of all, I didn't smoke a couple of joints before I went. But it was way different, because it was kind of like today when we came here. There was people outside, and they were laughing, smoking cigarettes, and they had a familiarity with each other. And they were friendly with each other. And it was weird. It's hard for me to blend in. I'm always watching you guys, just so you know. But anyway, it struck me that it was weird. It was very different. It was lit up, it was bright, and then they came in the room, and they got quiet, and they did a prayer, and then they read some stuff out of the book, and then someone shared something really inappropriate, and people were laughing, and I thought, this is the weirdest church service I've ever been to. And I was like, this is really weird. It's really different. I had never been to anything like this, that before. And the people had a familiarity with each other. But then what happened at my very first meeting, the guy got up on the podium, like this one. His name was Red, but he had white hair. He had long white hair. And he told a story about how he owned a roofing company. And that he always got on the roof in the morning, because if he went on the roof after lunch, he always fell off. And I related to it. I related to it because I was working in a fighting room. My job I was an oiler. And so my job was, I got the job because the guy got hung. So it was a pretty dangerous job. But my job was to service machinery while I was making plywood. I actually dove for my life a few times. Like, places that I would have saw was coming at, or where I was standing would disappear and go into a machine, or there's always chains and stuff going around. And so I had my own secret rule that I never told anyone, is that I keep my feet on the concrete after lunch. Because every day at lunch, I would go out to my car, and I would smoke half a joint, and then I would go back. And the last 3 hours of work, I'd be thinking about the joint in the ashtray and the one beer in town. Because I would smoke the joint on my way into town and have one, just one beer. How many beers you had, Bob? Just one.
But
so it kind of caught my ears went up. I was like, I never heard anyone describe the way that I felt before. But what really struck me was that he didn't look like a guy that couldn't go on the roof after lunch. And it made me start listening to what they were kind of saying. They weren't just testifying, but they really were talking about what happened. But what really struck me is that when they were telling their story, it's almost as if they were telling the story that belonged to somebody else. Because the way that they described the way that it was, that guy was not standing in front of me. Now, in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Sokler talks about that. He says, you know, this guy, a year later, he came to me and he visited me. For the life of me, I couldn't know that I had known him before. And so that's what struck me. Now, I'm terrible. I'm a high school dropout. I never took algebra. I never did anything anybody ever told me to do. I'm pretty mechanical. But the way that I learn is by watching you. I never was physical. Easiest class to cut and get high was PE. And the way that I got to the Army is I would be doing something and I'd look at the guy next to me and I'd see how he was doing it. And if that guy could do it, well, so can I. And running, I mean, I'd be running and I'd look at the guy just over there and I'd stick up with him, and if he fell away, I'd pick somebody else and I'd done with that one. But what got me was that I wanted what these people had. They talked about living indoors. They talked about having honest relationships. They talked about being happy and having peace. I only drank and used, really. You get right down to it. I only drank and used because I wanted to feel good and I wanted to be happy. That's the only reason. I didn't do it. I mean, yeah, when I was in high school, I did it to look cool. Or when I was in junior high. Or when I was in fifth grade and I was cutting class and hanging out in empty houses and drinking beers. I mean, I did it to be cool, but I just did it to feel good and to be happy and to be okay. And that's the only reason. And I was thinking, if these guys can do this, well, maybe I can too. And we read the instructions. Dan read the instructions. How to do this. I mean, it's really simple. It's simpler than, if you ever buy anything from IKEA, it's simpler than the steps in a fucking bookcase from IKEA. It's not, you know, it's simple, but it's you got to do it. I mean, I found that I had to do it. I was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and I woke up one day, and I didn't want to drink, and I didn't want to use, and I had never felt that way before. Because up until that moment, I was either high or drunk, or I was wanting to get high or drunk, or I was trying to figure out, or I was listening to somebody talk, thinking about how I was going to get away from them and go get some booze or some drugs. And I woke up one morning, and I didn't want to get high. I never gave permission for that. I don't know that I prayed for it, but it happened, and I knew it happened. And so they were talking about in the book, I told you I was illiterate, and I don't really understand a lot of them. I didn't understand a lot of the words in the big book, because in 1939, Bill took a writing class and did a really good job of finding words that were very descriptive of exactly what he was talking about. But in the meetings, we were talking about our continuing sobriety is contingent on a daily reprieve based on our spiritual makeup. I didn't know what any of those words meant. I thought it meant I needed to make a decision. See, what happened was I got confused with the doctor's opinion. When Dr. Sokler talks about making a decision, you know, we make lots of pledges and promises, but never a decision. And so I got those kind of mixed up. And in the meeting, they were talking about, that if you want something you've never had, you're going to have to do something you've never done. And that if I stayed the guy that I was, that guy would get drunk. That guy always got drunk. Every single time, that guy got drunk. And that I needed a new playground, playmate, plaything. I needed a new game. And I could be anybody that I wanted to be if I was willing to pay the price. There's a price for everything. Gas isn't free. If you want to go for a ride, you got to buy gas. I was willing to pay the price. And I could be any way I wanted. Now, I never brush my teeth on a regular basis. I don't say that to be embarrassing and self-deprecating, but it wasn't that important to me. I lived in a place where it wasn't that important to the people that were around me. It wasn't that important to my wife. Like, I don't know. I got married when I was 18. I was just thinking about this. You forget about stuff. Like, you come through in different places. Like, I came through under a boat one time. I came through in the wrong building one time. It was a bed, and when I was in the army, I woke up in another barracks in a bed somewhere with a bunch of guys I didn't know. I woke up in a water bed one time, and I vomited all over it. And when I rolled over, it rolled over with me. But I made a pact, whatever it was, because I knew that a shift had happened. I knew that something had happened, and I didn't do it. And I didn't really know what God was. I mean, Frank Zappa says, wherein it is written, or whatever it is, and write it on up there, whatever it was that took that away, I was praying for it. And so, what happened was, I made a pact with it. And if I could get up in the morning and brush my teeth, it was a physical decision to stay sober for one day. So I would get out of bed, I was in a hospital room, I would get out of bed, I would go in the bathroom, I would look at myself in the mirror, and I would brush my teeth, and I would say, God, you are making a decision not to drink or use today, no matter what. And then I did everything they told me to do in the treatment center. If they said write a lifeline, I wrote a lifeline. If they said write a story, I wrote a story. If they said write about my sex inventory, I wrote about it. Everything that they asked me to do. I meditated. I learned to meditate. I learned biofeedback meditation. I learned, I would go to the gym, and they would say, we're going for a walk, and I would go for a walk. And I let go. We have it here. Our hall, I used to have a white flag. I waved a white flag. I surrendered to the program. I want this thing. You guys got it. I want it. And I was so proud that, I was still hurting knowing that I had screwed around with my wife. And I read those steps. And so when I had 3 weeks, I did step 9. And I told my wife what a horrible husband I was, that I was having sex with her best friend. And I don't recommend that. I really don't. But things happen, and she didn't come to visit me, so I got out of the hospital. But I really wanted this to happen. When I got out of the hospital, I had to go to my home group, which is San Diego, Oregon. It had one meeting a week, Friday night, 8 o'clock, and it was in the cafeteria of an elementary school. So it had a little bitty And I was the 7th alcoholic in my home group. Like, if everybody showed up, there were 7 of us. We had one meeting a week. Same book. Well, the different edition, but the same book. Treatment. When the first shuttle blew up, I was in treatment. That's how long I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. Since the first shuttle blew up. I remember watching that in the day room monitor. We didn't call them monitors then. They were TVs. We didn't have monitors, we had TVs back then. So my very first meeting in Canyonville, I asked a guy to be my sponsor, and he hurt my feelings. He said he didn't want what I have, that he had it and it sucked. He said he's never going to buy me a cup of coffee. He said, I'm never taking you to a meeting. I'm never buying you dinner. I don't even want your phone number. I don't want what you have. But if you want what I have, you're going to have to call me. I'm not going to take the steps for you, Bob. You're going to have to take these steps on your own. And you're going to have to figure out what this is. And this is where I go. Because I go to Choo-Choo Willie's every night at 6 o'clock to have dinner. And if you want to talk about sobriety, that's where I'm going to be. And then I told him my whole story and woe with my wife. He said, what? If you want to stay married, you're going to have to be the husband she thinks you ought to be. And so that's how I do it. I go to meetings every Friday night. I was brushing my teeth in the morning, and I was praying, and I really wanted this thing to happen. And I started making coffee at the meeting, because sometimes it would just be two people. Sometimes it would be one person. Like if everybody showed up, there were seven of us, but that didn't happen very often. It was a really small group, intimate AA. I love AA up here. Like, just like everybody tells their story every single week. And I did a 12-step call, like just 12-step call, and went to 90 days. A friend of mine, a guy that gave me a job in the guy army, was going to kill himself. And so he was in a field with a shotgun in his truck. And, you know, it was a sad story, but I needed to work with other people. I see that the 12-step is an important part of my program. It's really important, I think. So I get him, and I said, you got to go home. We're going to go home. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm going to kill myself. Because what happened was, oh, I'm going to tell Art's story. What happened was, he woke up one day. This is a terrible story. He woke up one day with a cop sitting on the door. They came in, they arrested him, they took him to jail. He was a terrible girl. Like, he would lose his shoes. Like, he would go Saturday morning, he was in the town of Myrtle Creek, Oregon, there was three bars. And he would go and have to search each bar to find his shoes, because he would always lose his shoes. That's kind of, he was black out one. They arrested him because the night before, he had molested his neighbor's daughter. He had broken her house and molested her, and then came home and went to sleep on the couch. And the cops came and arrested him and took him to jail. And he's like, what the fuck? So he said he had to go to AA. So he went to AA, and there weren't a lot of people there. But the people that were there were talking about what a piece of shit he was. And he's like, Bob, I can't even go to AA. What am I going to do? And so he had to go to AA in another town. But I just remember that he wouldn't get in the car unless I promised to buy him a beer. And then and I go, okay, I'll get you a beer. He goes, Bob, it takes two beers to get home from here. So I had to buy two beers. I got a dog in sobriety. I got a dog, and I started running with the dog. And I really wanted to happen, but when I got, I don't know if you guys all were pretty successful, but I didn't find a dope when I went in treatment, so I had to go and pay that guy, and I knew what was looking for me. So I laid his money on that table, and he goes, okay, do you want some? And my first thought was, yeah. And my second thought was, Bob, you brushed your teeth this morning. You made a decision not to drink or use today, no matter what. And then that was at that moment I realized, no matter what meant, even if it was free. And I made it. That has saved me numerous times. I've had a lot of things. When I was in 6 months, I found a Tuesday night meeting I could go to. My friend said, there's a Tuesday night meeting you can go to. I'm like, cool, what is it? He goes, well, there's a volunteer police force in the town, and Tuesday night we do our training. So I started going to the Tuesday night training for the police force, and I told my sponsor everything. I said, Bob, whatever you do, don't swear in. He goes, you shouldn't make any major decisions for a year. Becoming a policeman in your hometown is kind of a major decision. I said, yeah, but it's Tuesday night. I'm learning about police procedures and shit. So when I had a year, I got sworn in as a reserve officer in my hometown. And I figured it was a way for me to burn my bridges, because everybody knew it was a small town. I couldn't buy drugs in my hometown. I really never want to drink or use again one day at a time. Really, I don't. I really didn't want to be a policeman. I found out after I became a policeman, I decided I didn't really want to be a policeman. And so my cousin called me and he said, hey, he was a construction coordinator at the studios, and they were on strike. He said, hey, you want to come and build apartments? And I'm like, yeah, I'm ready for an adventure. I've been sober a year and a half, and took on the world. So I put everything in storage. I resigned from the police force. I resigned from the plywood mill, loaded up my tools, put my everything I owned in storage, my wife, my kids, went to my mother-in-law, and I hit the road for L.A. And I was on the road for about 10 minutes, and this little voice said, "Bob, nobody knows you're an alcoholic in L.A. This is Bob. You could probably smoke pot." I'm like, no. And I see this hitchhiker, and he looked kind of crunchy. And I'm like, you know, because I hitchhiked that I-5 quarter a million times. And I'm like, you know, if that guy starts talking about cutting people up, man, he's off to the next opera. And this guy, I'm in my van, and he had just gotten out of a treatment center in Seattle, Washington. And he was on his way to Florida. He said, yeah, a 14-hour meeting all the way into L.A. I got to L.A. and I need to go to meetings. I became a part of the Burbank group. They hurt my feelings. They were like, "Get me out of town." I'm like, "Yeah, I'm out of town." Nobody talked to me. They didn't have greeters. They weren't that friendly to me. They were friendly with each other, but I didn't understand it. Because when I was in my home, I mean, AA was so small. If somebody was new, you knew it. You flocked around it. If somebody to hang out. But I didn't, and then I was talking to a coffee maker and said, "Bob, maybe you're going to leave R. You're going to have to stick your hand out. They're not going to take the effort to meet you. You're going to have to take the effort to meet them." And so I got a commitment as a preacher where I would stand at the door and shake everyone's hand. I said, "Welcome, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic." And then I got a sponsor there was this Wednesday night meeting. I hated it. It was a terrible meeting. It was a meeting where they had 2 10-minute speakers, and then at the break they passed out paper, and then they would answer questions. And the questions were always like, "What size shoes did Bill wear?" Well, you know, it was a terrible meeting. I hated that meeting. But my sponsor was the secretary. He said, "Bob, I want you to be my coffee maker." And I said, "I hate this meeting. I'm not going to do that." He goes, "No, I really need it." "I don't want to." He goes, "Bob," and he messed me up. And he really messed me up. He said, "Bob, you may be the only big book the newcomer reads." And I'm like, so it's a 6-month commitment. I kept it for 9 months. And I made it my point to meet everybody that came in the meeting. And so I became a part of it. My wife divorced me on my 11th wedding anniversary over the phone. She said, I sang happy anniversary to her, and she said, "Oh, by the way, I took the papers," and she divorced me. And the only time I ever liked her, I felt like killing myself. But I went to a meeting, and a guy said that he came to Alcoholics Anonymous to keep his family together. He'd stay married and be around his kids. And he said, "But today, I'm the best weekend dad that I can be. I pay my child support, and I'm still with my ex-wife." He said, "What I really found out was that I actually came to Alcoholics Anonymous to get a life that was acceptable to me." And I didn't tell myself that night. And I realized that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm here to have a life that's acceptable to me. I eventually worked my way into the studios. I was a carpenter in the studio. The first day in the studios was on Doogie Howser. And we didn't know what it was about, but I started as a prop maker, and I ended up at Warner Brothers, where I met my lovely wife. And I worked my way into special effects. Right about that time, my ex-wife had dumped the kids off, and I ended up in legal physical custody of 3 small children in sobriety. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. She had dumped them at her connection's house after her and her boyfriend, who was HIV positive, and molested all 3 of them. And I really didn't know what to do. And the book talks about, you know, I'm agitated, and paused, and so I paused and I prayed about it. I got the idea to turn them over to the States for temporary placement. And so it took 4 months for them to get placed in that home and move to a foster home. And so I was a single parent with these three up kids. And taking on the meetings, going to meetings. My daughter now, she's 40, and she was visiting this last year, and she said, "Bob," she said, "Papa," they call me Papa, He's like, whenever I smell crayons, I know it's going to be okay. Because when I was a little girl, you would drag us to meetings. And we would sit in the back of the room, and we had a shopping bag full of crayons and color books and puzzle books. And she said, and you would sit back there, and you would talk to those people, and they would talk to you, and I knew that we were going to be okay. And she says, even now, every time she smells crayons, she says, I know it's going to be okay. Because since I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been okay. It hasn't been easy, but it's been okay. I met a woman in AA who didn't want anything to do with me, and I gave up chasing her, and she wanted something to do with me. And we got married in 1994 at a wedding that we made it remote so nobody could drink, and my family's crazy. So we set it up so nobody could get booze or drugs there. And all our friends showed up. It's the friend I always wanted. I've gotten an Alcoholics Anonymous. I work my way into special effects. I'm a licensed pyrotechnician. I get paid to light people on fire and shoot guns with them, shoot guns at them. I worked on movies and television. I just retired last year from the movie industry. I used to be an expert at things, and today I'm not an expert at anything. I'm retired. And I really love it. I really love my life. I'm way overdue. I got in layers of pain. My lovely wife, who's been, she's my rock. She's the second best thing that ever happened to me. These Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that ever happened to me. I want to know there's a whole underground of people. When we watch movies and TV and production and stuff, there's a whole underground of people in recovery. I've met countless actors, crewmen, people. There's a whole bunch of special effects guys. There's a few fireworks shows with them. One time we were doing a fireworks show, it was a hand light show. Like sometimes, a lot of the time they put up people and they fire them on, but we were doing a hand light show. Basically what it is, you got these candles, and they're lined up in a row. And you got a rose there. And so you got a guy with you, and he's your safety, and he's supposed to watch you. Three people die doing this every year. So I'm firing it off, and pull the cover off the fuse. He's got this on the music, and he's like, da 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 I'm on fire! And he goes, yeah, man, this is great! I don't know, man! I'm on fire! Put me out! And so, you know, he did. And so I thought, you know, what a great story. You know? If you're ever on fire, I hope there's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous standing next to you. But that's really not the story, you see. I knew that I was on fire. And I had a member of Alcoholics Anonymous standing right next to me, watching me. And he couldn't see that I was on fire. Then I told him I was on fire, but he didn't believe me. I had to convince him that I was on fire before he could help me. I've been to a lot of meetings. I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous since 1986. And I have thousands. I have sponsors. I'm at 100% success rate in my sponsorship because I'm still sober. A lot of them aren't yet. I got my four sponsors. I've been to the steps countless times. And I can't read people's minds. I can't read your inside by your outside. And sometimes I'm really not listening that much. I hear a lot of stuff. So you're going to have to get my attention before I can help you. And if you're an Alcoholics Anonymous, that's really what we're here for. You know, we always talk about, you know, the newcomer is the most important person in the room. Well, they may not know how to tell you that they're on fire if they're not listening. See, I try to listen, and I fail at it constantly. But if you're in a meeting tonight, and something's burning you up, and you're on fire, and you need help, you have to ask us. We can't read your mind. I wish we could. Alcoholics Anonymous has been so much fun. I have been to meetings around the world. I was the main speaker in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting one time in Mexico. I didn't know it till after I shared. But, you know, it could work out. It's okay. I really love my life. A couple of years ago, I got kind of bored with my program. And that thing, if you want something you've never had, you're going to have to do something you've never done. I remember that. And I was looking for a new sponsor. I always had a sponsor who had no time in me. I thought that was a requirement. But what I was finding is a lot of people with more time than me aren't very happy. And there's not a lot of them. I mean, I don't know if you know that our newcomers, I mean our old-timers, there's not a lot of old-timers anymore. And so I started looking around, and I started going, well, you know, maybe I should find somebody else. And I found a guy who had what I wanted. He was happy. And his story, he was the angriest man alive, but he was pretty happy. And he was happily married. Somebody put up with him, and he was happily married. And I had taken a step, and I asked him to be my sponsor. I said, listen, I want you to take me through the steps how you went through the steps. So I bought a new big book and a new 12-12. And I said, if I was new, what would you have me do? And I just did. I just let go and trust God. I did what he said to do, the way that he said to do it, because I wanted a different experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to drink to start over. I did. I learned some things in it that I hadn't looked at before. I did some inventories that he had talked about that I hadn't done before, and I got a different perspective of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know this can work. I have a sponsor now that I'm going through a bunch of booklets from Hazelton and good booklets, and I'm taking them through that. And I'm learning. I'm learning so much about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this program. I love the people in it, alcoholics in my tribe. It's the craziest goddamn church. It's the only church in town that doesn't give a fuck who your God is as long as it's not you. And I see his miracles all the time. I see it in the newcomers and the oldcomers. I see it and I love it. I love being a part of it. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. And if you're new, if someone tells you to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous, ask them what they did. A sponsor said to me when I said, if anybody in AA tells you to do something, tell them to fuck off. And ask them what they did and how it worked out. And so that's what I do. I let people know what I did and I tell the truth. I don't know who that guy is. Like, I was never that guy before, telling the truth, even when it didn't make me look good. Anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really grateful to be here. That's all I got to say. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you for your wonderful life.
Keep coming back. It works.
Another round of applause for both of our speakers tonight. And Sammy and Bob, thank you so much. That was amazing.